From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. This week marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech at the historic 1963 March on Washington. In the days leading up to that anniversary, the news press has been running a special series looking into race relations in Southwest Florida in the days of segregation through today. We'll talk with the reporters behind that special series titled Dreaming in Color, I Have a Dream 50 Years Later. Plus, foreign illegal fishing in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a growing problem that poses risks to our economy, national security, the sustainability of the industry, and has even been linked to drug smuggling and human trafficking operations. Yet few of us even know what happens. We'll explore the extent of the problem, as well as a pair of bills in the U.S. Senate aimed at addressing the issue. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Foreign illegal fishing in the Gulf of Mexico. It's not a problem that we hear too much about, but experts in the fishing industry say it's a growing problem, posing risk to the economy, national security, and sustainability of important fish populations. It's even been linked to drug smuggling and human trafficking. We'll explore the extent of the problem, as well as legislative efforts aimed at addressing it later this hour. But first, today marks the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech delivered on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial at the historic 1963 March on Washington. That event is credited with leading to the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And in the days leading up to the anniversary, the Fort Myers News Press has been running a special series looking into the impact of King's speech on local residents and getting a variety of perspectives on the state of race relations in our Southwest Florida communities then and now. Joining me now are the news press reporters behind that project titled Dreaming in Color, I Have a Dream 50 Years Later. They spent the last several months collecting the stories and perspectives of more than 50 community members and leaders from all walks of life. Melanie Payne is the watchdog reporter behind the news press column Tell Mel. Melanie Payne, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Well, thanks so much for having us.
Also with us in studio is news press storytellers and causes reporter Janine Zeitlin. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. What's your take on the state of race relations here in Southwest Florida? What do you think about the amount of progress that's been made since Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech? Connect with our guests and join the conversation by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Share your questions or comments on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And first of all, Janine, tell us a bit about how you've structured this special reporting project. Would you say this is primarily an oral retrospective?
I would say that we tried to build an oral history starting from the day of the speech and a little bit before to get a sense of kind of where we were at in Southwest Florida. We were heavily segregated at the time, and blacks and whites lived separately. They swam at separate beaches, went to different schools, and then we tried to build the history and the story to the present, talking to kids. Our youngest interviewee was 12 years old.
And your oldest was?
95.
95. So yeah. Truly a demographic cross-section.
Yes.
There. And certainly the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech gave the timely news peg for doing this project. But Melanie, were there other reasons that the two of you wanted to do an extensive project like this?
Well, we had been talking about issues in Fort Myers, and this, in fact, doing this gave us some more perspective on race relations as they stand today. We had not really understood why we remained, in many ways, such a segregated community, and I think that this gave us a lot of insight into that.
And as we've mentioned, you interviewed more than 50 people. How did you identify who you wanted to speak with?
A lot of it was just volunteering. people, we put notices in the paper and online, and people approached us. The other thing that was kind of interesting about it, John, was that a lot of people didn't want to talk about it. It brought up really very painful memories. And for me personally, I was triggered by a lot of things. I grew up in the North, but we still encountered a lot of racism. And there were things from that time that kind of brought a lump in my throat when people would start talking about them.
Given the difficulty of this topic and maybe the reluctance of some people to bring up some of those memories, did that impact your approach to how you structured the interviews?
No, I don't think so. We kind of let people talk about what they wanted to talk about. And if people seemed reluctant, we were kind of prepared in advance to say, can you give us an example of this? Most of the people we pre-screened on the phone when we talked to them.
And Janine, when we spoke last week, you had mentioned that it was the responses of the kids that surprised you the most. Why is that?
I think I had been talking to adults before I started talking to the kids, and they had a sense that things were so much better, and they are. It really is. But when I sat down and talked with the kids, and I asked them, "Well, do you think Dr. King's dream has come true in your life in terms of being judged by your character instead of your color?" And I expected it to be kind of a mixed bag, but pretty much all of them said no. And they had really personal and heartbreaking stories to illustrate that.
Well, let's maybe talk just a little bit about what some of those stories were. What were some of the stories from the kids that really impacted you, or maybe you thought this is something we want to feature?
I think three stick out in my mind in particular. One was a girl, the 12-year-old, the youngest that we interviewed, and she told us a story about being in Bible class, and there was a gap in the circle, and the teacher told the other girl sitting next to her, who was white, to close the gap. And the girl said no, and the teacher said why, and the girl said because she's black. And there was another incident of a teenager who's in Pop Warner football, and he was playing with a nearly all African American team against a white team, and they beat the white team. And when they came out of the locker room, there were racial slurs written on one of the cars directed at them, the N word, saying we hate these people, they should go back to being slaves. And just hearing those kinds of words, and that kids are relating like that to each other, I really didn't think it was happening in that kind of overt way.
And Melanie, tell me, was there any particular interview or set of interviews that kind of intrigued you the most?
I'll tell you, one of the things was stories of people actually being active in the integration movement. I was very touched by those stories. And I think Ida Mae Golden's story of going into a restaurant and being and someone dumping ketchup on them while they were in the restaurant. And someone told me that that's in a recent movie now, the same type of incident in The Butler. And I
any word on if that was maybe inspired by this real story here in Fort Myers?
I think that it probably happened a lot.
Yeah.
And when she told this story, she was kind of she couldn't remember exactly the date. And when I called her back, I said, well, maybe you could call some of the other people who remember the date of this. And she said, Melanie, they're all gone. I'm the only one left. And at that moment, I felt, oh, boy, Janine and I have really done a good thing, because we are getting down stories that may be lost if we had not done this project.
Well, tell us just a little bit more about that story, because if you haven't read the series, the ending isn't quite so bad.
No, the ending's actually very hopeful. There was a very popular restaurant in downtown Fort Myers called the Snack House. And Miss Golden, we're not sure. She said that she thought that they were integrating, and because other places downtown had. So after church, and five of them went to this restaurant, and instead of going to the back pickup window where blacks always went, they all went inside and sat at a booth, and they did not get served. And finally, one of the servers came up to them and stood and looked at them and then took ketchup and started dumping ketchup all over them in their hair and on their clothes and everything. And they peacefully left the restaurant. And 2 weeks later, after having a conversation with the Reverend Isidore Edwards, the owner of the restaurant sent them a letter and said, you know, I'd like you to come back, and apologized. And she and one other woman went back. The three of them did not.
Wow, yeah, that is a very hopeful story in the end. Yeah. Upon the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in the 1963 March on Washington, we're taking a closer look at the state of race relations in Fort Myers then and now with Melanie Payne and Janine Zeitlin of the News Press. They're the reporters behind the paper's special oral retrospective series, Dreaming in Color, I Have a Dream 50 Years Later. You can join our conversation with a phone call to 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And one fact I read from that series that really struck me was in regards to Veronica Shoemaker, who we know became the first black member elected to the Fort Myers City Council. That was in 1982, but she'd run campaigns for years prior to that. And in the early days, you write that when she would go door to door campaigning through white neighborhoods, she would actually have to go knock on the back door.
Yes.
We've certainly come a long way since then, but as your series notes, as late as 1997, Fort Myers was recognized as the most segregated city in the South, according to a National University study. What was the result of Fort Myers receiving that distinction, and was that something that maybe shocked you?
I think that's fairly, from people who have been here for a while, that's fairly well-known known fact. And it's not something most people wear proudly.
Well, sure.
And there's actually a group of residents that came together and created Lee County Pulling Together in response to that. And it started conversations of, well, how do we make this better? And I talked to some of the people who were involved in that effort. They discussed just simply inviting like an African American or a white person to dinner that you didn't know. They really wanted to start on like a really personal basis, and they also took people who worked for the city and the county into neighborhoods in Dunbar, which are primarily African American, who were responsible for projects in Dunbar, but who had never visited Dunbar. Mm-hmm. So they tried to get people to know the community in a different way than they had.
And from the interviews you've conducted with longtime black residents of the area, what can you tell us about what they've told you about their experience of living in the region in the days before desegregation?
It was very interesting because occasionally we would have someone, a white person earlier and then a black person. And Janine and I would, after the interview, look and say, were these people living in the same place?
Yeah.
And it just really seemed like their experiences were so different and their perception of how things were so different. I can't tell you how many of the white people that we interviewed said we all got along. It was not that time. Another person told us that she had read the book The Help, and she said it was not like that in Fort Myers. And from everything that everyone else was telling us, it was like that in Fort Myers, and we were really surprised at the difference in perception.
And people said, well, we white people said we treated the black people who worked for us like family. But then we would hear stories about, not being able to having the African-American people in their homes who were helping them clean, but they wouldn't be able to sit at the table. They refused to allow them to sit at the family table. So it was like, on the one hand, you're saying, we treated everyone like family, but they had to stand at the back of the line at the store.
Hmm. Yeah. That's very interesting that even after all this time, that those are the perspectives that people still hold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. It was insightful.
Yeah. Well, let's hear now from Vivian. Vivian moved here from Ohio and wants to tell us a bit about her experience. Vivian, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Yes, my name is Vivian.
Go ahead, tell us your story. You're on the air.
I moved from Ohio, and I moved down here because I felt that I needed a better climate for my son. However, I found out that even though I had the funds, I wasn't able to move into the gated communities. And I wonder why the gated communities would not let blacks move in. And I thought that was really a sign of discrimination. And I was wondering if anyone had any kind of views as to why they do that. Because I feel that this is definitely a type of discrimination.
Vivian, what year did you move here? When was that?
That was in 1964. That was in 1964. And then I kept trying in 1967, and it was still the same situation. And so I was forced to move further down the line, but I just felt really bad about that whole situation.
Yeah. Any insights on that, Melanie?
Well, I think that Fort Myers was very far behind, and especially Vivian, I come from Ohio also, and those types of problems, I think, were much more prevalent here. We found deeds from 1962 saying that you couldn't sell your house to a black person or rent your house to a black person in certain neighborhoods. So this was really a lot later than places in the North. And I just think that Janine can talk a little bit about the school integration. You know, they were building black schools in the 1960s and well after Brown versus Board of Education.
I was teaching, and I had to teach in the Dunbar Community School where they were all blacks. But I was trying to get another job that was more convenient, and I finally got a job in Cape Coral, but I really wasn't treated very kindly.
And I did want to add, Vivian, that we did hear from other people who had experienced similar types of situations where they had moved into a gated community and had difficulties with the homeowners association, and they were African American residents. And then I met a couple. She was a retired utility executive, and he was a retired school superintendent. And she said, in South Fort Myers, they moved into a gated community, but the developer put all kinds of barricades and barriers to make it really difficult for them to move in. And they were both African American as well.
Hmm. Well, Vivian, thank you so much for the call and for giving us the talking points there. Thanks so much for joining that conversation. I wanted to go to the phones now and take a call from Joanne in Naples. Joanne, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you. And I get very emotional, so I don't know. Feel free to cut me off if I break down.
Okay.
I'm a 70-year-old white Italian-American, and I've lived in Collier County for 23 years. I have an adopted black son who we adopted when he was 15 months old. And when he was in college, he's now married with two children. But when he was in college, he came down to stay with us, and he was parking cars, I think at the Ritz-Carlton for summer money. And we lent him our car. He was pulled over only because he was a black kid driving our 86-year-old diesel Mercedes, and the cops pulled him over. And he, you know, gave him the registration, said it was his father. Of course, he has an Italian last name, and he doesn't look Italian. And they kind of gave him a hard time, but then it worked out. And he's still, to today, you know, I have so much hope things are so much better. But today, if his job takes him to Alabama or Mississippi, and he has one of those hoodies on, he gets pulled over for no reason. So I just wanted people to know that we still have to look at people for who they are.
Well, Joanne, thanks so much for the call. I really think it goes to remind us, and so much of what this series does is remind us that there are still issues here, and that we have communities in Fort Myers that are still very, you know, divided racially.
Well, today the video that posted today, I think, is the one that tells us that there's a lot of work to do, and I think it's one of the better videos in the series that we have, and it talks about how we've made really, really great strides. I mean, anyone who was alive in 1963 can attest to the fact that it is not 1963 anymore. Yes. But we do have a lot of work still to do, and we need to be willing to recognize it and do it and move on.
I kind of wanted to move on a little bit to, you know, the topic of school integration here, because that was something that was very volatile. And didn't happen right away. Janine, what can you tell us about the history of school integration in this area?
Well, Brown versus Board of Education was 1954, which led to the end of segregation in schools. But it wasn't until 64 when the NAACP, Lee County NAACP, and a group of black parents filed a lawsuit to end school segregation that Lee County started to try to do some things. And it was, in the beginning, it was very kind of token efforts. They put a white science teacher in an all-black school in Dunbar, replaced the African-American principal with a white teacher. And they sent a woman, and she didn't appear in the videos, but we interviewed her, who drove around to the various Lee County schools so people could get used to seeing a person of color. And she would receive threats. The principals would receive threats. Don't let that, you know, woman into the school. But she still went. I mean, and we heard these stories. I mean, that was one of the stories that just the courage of the people here and the people who still live here and are such vital assets in our community.
Go ahead, Melanie.
And I was going to say that went both ways. There were a lot of not just black people who did courageous things. There were a lot of white people who also did courageous things and intervened. And Joe D'Alessandro tells a fabulous story, and everyone concurs that it was his mom holding a tea for Veronica Shoemaker that made all the difference. It said, look, she's coming in my front door, and you're having tea with her. And, you know, and it gave people the courage to vote for her.
Yeah. And do you want to say something else, Jimmy?
Well, and, you know, Fort Myers also did kind of Lee County also did an interesting thing where they were trying to comply with the judge's order to integrate the school, and they sent all of the seventh graders to two schools in Dunbar, and that actually went pretty smoothly. And it was interesting to talk to the white students as well. We spoke with Virginia Henderson, who is the wife of the Fort Myers mayor, and she said, you know, her parents were a little bit nervous, but she said, no, I want to go to school with my friends. And she said, you know, in that school, they weren't really worried about that. They were worried about what their boyfriends, who were their boyfriends, and what their hair looked like. But really,
typical stuff middle schoolers
exactly,
are interested in,
exactly.
Not making history.
Yes, exactly. Hmm. But it was really at the high schools, I would say, where things got volatile. There were a lot of fights. Dogs were brought in. There were injuries and arrests.
Well, there was a riot at the first pep rally of the year at Fort Myers High School. Tell us a little bit about the context around that. They were playing a song, Dixie?
Dixie. According to our newspaper, which was really interesting to review, Dixie was played at a pep rally, and there were some tensions because a white student had filled like a black student's purse with water. So things were already kind of on edge. And then once Dixie started to play, a fight broke out and there was bedlam. And I believe the principal called it hysteria.
Yeah. People were running and screaming. Mm-hmm. And
tensions remained high for a while after that.
Several years, particularly at Fort Myers High, that seemed to be really the place where a lot of the tensions happened. We talked to people who had worked in North Fort Myers, and they said there were conflicts, but not to that degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, and fast forwarding a bit, it was only in 1999 when a federal judge finally ruled that Lee County offers equitable education that ended a 35-year lawsuit and court oversight over the district. What insights have you gained into why it took so long for that to occur, for equality in the schools to?
Well, one of the difficulties was with the busing situation. For a really long time, that they were busing only minority students, and white parents didn't necessarily want to send their kids into black neighborhoods, so that made it difficult for the district to comply with the order, and we heard an interesting story from Charles Daly, who was working for the district at the time, and he was trying to explain to white parents why they needed to send their kids to schools outside of their neighborhoods, and he received threats. His home received a call that said that, you know, your daddy is a dead man. His daughter, he came home to find his daughter and wife crying. There were tacks put in his car. I mean, it was a difficult time here. Yeah.
And we also had such a long way to go. I mean, it wasn't like other places. I mean, the South, for the most part, and that study showed, black people and white people weren't as segregated. Almost all the cities on that list of segregated cities were in the North. Now, you know, Fort Myers was the most segregated city in the South, but it was actually number 11 on segregated cities. So in other places, I think that blacks and whites may have had a closer relationship than they did here in terms of where they had to go.
Well, I like how the series also speaks with people who came after desegregation, maybe in the 70s, and just talking about their experience with that. Folks like Reginald and Bernadette Billups and Lee Memorial Health System's Jim Nathan. Tell me a little bit about their experiences and what they told you.
I think that they were shocked. Mm. And that's when we talk about how far we had to go. One of the stories that didn't make it was Jim Nathan and his wife were very good friends with a black couple. And when they were getting ready to move to Fort Myers, they said to them, oh, well, you'll come down and visit us, you know, because who doesn't want to go to Florida? And he said the couple were kind of looking at each other like, well, we'll see you when you come back up to Cincinnati. And he said he really couldn't understand that until they actually got down here and saw that things were so slow to change here.
I was surprised to see that when Jim Nathan did come down, it was just 9 years after the black hospital had closed and that Lee Memorial had actually began admitting black patients.
Right.
The 70s. It just seems like you would have thought that would have happened much earlier in history, but not so here.
No, not at all. And he also tells a story about someone asking him about, did they mix black blood and white blood? And that story came from the 70s also.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. For the record, it's about type, not type is what we're worried about there. Well, and then you know, moving even further, you spoke with residents who've moved here, you know, just in a few recent years, and I'm thinking specifically of Deanna Dorsey, a young black professional woman, landed a job as a buyer at Chico's, and talks about, you know, seeing this very physical divide, saying the white people live here and the black people live here, and she herself identifies as living on the white side, and just sort of talks about this sense of alienation that she feels.
I think that was one of the aha moments for me, and I think Melanie as well, when she did the interview. Because you think that, you know, Dunbar is so close and the River District are so close together. So why is it that an African-American professional woman can't feel comfortable or welcome in places? And it shouldn't be. She talked about, you know, she goes to downtown restaurants. She just feels all the people looking and staring at her. And sometimes she just waves. And she said, and she was really brave, too, as well. She said, you know, some of these people have never been friends with an African-American. So I'm going to let that experience being friends with me be a good one.
Well, I was wondering also just about, lastly, here we are about running out of time, but the feedback you've received from the series so far. I've looked at some of the online comments posted to the news press, and folks, well, and this is just one, you know, criticism that I see that keeps coming up is people feel like doing projects like this only serves to keep these racial tensions alive, in a sense. What's your response to those kind of comments?
I really think that we have to confront what went on and acknowledge it and deal with it in order to move on. And I just don't feel like covering it up and forgetting about it is the way to go when it comes to dealing with it, because there's a lot of hurt out there. And I think people need to recognize where what people's experience has been in order to make a change.
Well, that is about all the time we have for this portion of the program. But I want to thank my guests, News Press storytellers and causes reporter Janine Zeitlin and News Press watchdog columnist Melanie Payne. They're the driving force behind the paper's special series, Dreaming in Color, I Have a Dream 50 Years Later, commemorating the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's famous speech and exploring the state of race relations in Fort Myers then and now. That series has appeared in the Saturday through Wednesday editions of the News Press, and all of it's available online at newspress.com/sections/dream. Melanie and Janine, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having us.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, illegal fishing in the Gulf of Mexico. It's a largely unknown problem, but experts say it's posing risk to the economy, national security, and sustainability, and it's growing. We'll take a closer look just ahead. Stay with us.